Ramsey TV.
Talk here is titled No More Fear. How's that? No More Fear. Yeah, you want to hear a good verse from Romans? I thought you did. Romans 8:15. For you did not get slavery spirit to fear again, but you got the spirit of sonship, in which we are crying, Abba, Father. I'll give you one little pre-look into this. Abba is a very familiar term. It means daddy. It's an intimate relationship. It is very rare that we have an intimate relationship with the deity. Now, the people to whom Paul is writing in the book of Romans, they were used to false deities. There are many termed gods in the world. There are false gods in the world. They're false gods, very powerful beings, celestial beings, spiritual beings who attempt to rule humanity, who want to corral humanity. And they have corralled them, these other small g gods have corrupted and corralled humanity into religion, into groups. And the one thing that all these false gods have in common is they keep you in line with fear. They rule by fear. And this is the general disposition of the gods, is rule by fear. Just like the general disposition of human beings is toward tyranny. If you look at the course of history, the natural way things go when human beings are in charge is tyranny. People want to rule other people. They want to have despotic power. And it's very unusual to have a representative government. It's a very rare thing on the earth to have people rule themselves, to appoint their own leaders and to rule themselves. It's very rare. And I can't even tell you how rare it is to have a deity, to have the deity, not a deity, the deity who does not rule by fear, but who rules by love and who smiles upon us. This is such a rare thing. And I don't know about you. Do you get this crazy thought once in a while where you think the worst? And the worst thing I can think of is, what if this is all a trick? It's all a joke. God's just really mean. And all this nice stuff is a front, and we're going to find out, and it's going to be terrifying. This is the standard issue thinking of humanity, because in the course of our history of this world, it's what we're used to, tyranny. And it's what we were raised in, religions. Do you know the word religion means... The Greek word translated religion in the Concordant version is diesi daimonia, big word. It's not something you get that you need an antiviral substance to get over. Diesi daimonia, it means dread demonism. Diesi is dread, daimonia, demonism. Religion is dread demonism. Satan rules by dread, and the other gods rule by dread. Whatever god is running the Christian religion, and there is a God behind the Christian religion. Just as there's a God behind Buddhism, there's a God behind Hinduism, there's a small g God behind Islam, they're all small g gods. There is a small g God running Christianity. We're going to meet that being someday. And that is one big, hairy, smelly, ugly being that has corralled humanity into a false religion that rules by fear. I was sitting next to a guy on the plane yesterday on the flight from Detroit. I went from Fort Lauderdale to Omaha. I went via Detroit. So I noticed this guy next to me, and I see he has these wooden beads. And I first thought it was a bracelet that he had. And I go, please, Lord, let that be a bracelet and not a rosary. No, it was a rosary. And the whole flight, this guy is clutching to his rosary. Because I think in his mind, being a superstitious man, a religious man, he was worried that the plane was going to crash. Or if he didn't clutch this rosary, in his superstitious mind, the God he worships, small g God he worships, would protect him if he held this icon, this object of veneration. And I noticed that when the plane landed, he put it in his pocket. He was done with it. Doesn't he know that it's more dangerous to drive home from the airport than it is to fly? He was much safer in the air, and yet he's clutching this object that proved to me that he did not know the true God. Because the true God is one of peace. not fear. Mark Twain, one of my favorite writers, he hated Christianity. But this guy, if you've ever read Mark Twain, he's so real, he's so true, he can spot religious hypocrisy a mile away, halfway down the Mississippi, he can see it coming, and he hated it. Because he was taught, like all of us were, a God of fear, a God of punishment, a God who's waiting for you to screw up, and he's going to pounce on you. And Mark Twain said, when he was a boy in Hannibal, Missouri, the thunderstorms would roll in at night, and the thunder to him spoke of God's irritation and the lightning of God's judgment. And he feared to death. He would shake in his bed. I think many of us did when we were kids. We shake thinking of the terrifying God who's in charge of the thunder, in charge of the lightning. But Mark Twain was taught a God of fear. Paul says we do not get slavery's spirit to fear again. I wish Mark Twain could have read How to Quit Church Without Quitting God. I think he would have liked it. Yeah. And I really do. I stood at Mark Twain's grave in Elmira, New York. And I was the only guy there at that time. It was a rainy day, and I'm standing there 8 feet from one of my heroes. 6 feet, sorry. Is that what they bury people these days? 6 feet. And I thought, man, if you only would have known, if you only would have known the true God, the God you hated, Samuel Clemens, the God you hated was the God, the false God, the false G God that runs the Christian religion, whoever taught you that God, Miss Watson, whoever, was wrong. It was wrong. You feared that God your whole life. And all the contradictory teachings that Mark Twain heard, he railed against it. Railed against the God of eternal torment. Railed against the God of human free will. Railed against him because he never knew the true God. Now, people aren't being driven away from the true God. Most people haven't seen the true God. They're being driven away from the false God. And I'm glad of it. I'm glad of it. The first thing I do when I meet an atheist is I give the atheist credit. Thank goodness you don't believe in the false God. You have more spiritual sensitivity. I think many atheists have more spiritual sense than the people sitting in the pews swallowing up the false teachings about the God who rules by fear. You know, worry kills more people than war. I wish I'd invented that phrase because it's so melodious. Worry kills more people than war. I read that from Mr. A. E. Nock in the Concordant Commentary. If we could calculate the people who have died from anxiety, from worry, with the underlying reason being their fear of God, and even some of the people in the Christian religion, don't you think? Because this guy was probably a Christian who was sitting next across the aisle from me on the plane. Don't you think that they fear? Don't you think that they're a misstep away from disappointing their small d deity? Of course they are. They're not content. They're not happy. That's why they have to keep going to church. They have to keep going to the altar call. Their God demands it. Their God demands continual devotion, continual renewal of dedication. Man, that's what I went through in the Catholic Church. What was confirmation? What was confession? It was a renewal, 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 renewal. Many of you have probably been, I don't know, been baptized more than once. It's a renewal, renewal. You never know. You never know. You might not have done it right the first time. It's terrifying. It's a rule by fear. And of course, Christians, we don't want to scare you into heaven. But that never works. I would like to see a follow-up. You know, you hear stories about how many people Billy Graham led people, but I'd like to, are there any follow-ups on those people that came to the altar? They counted people that came to the altar. Were there any follow-ups? That's what I'd like to know. What happened to those people afterwards? After they got over the excitement and the thrill of being in a stadium with Billy Graham, and they came to the altar for a bad case of virtue signaling, and what happened to them after that? I wrote an article on this theme called, in the ZWTF, called No More Fear. Your days of religion brought fear. Fear is slavery. To fear God is to suffer perpetual anxiety. Many religionists profess confidence in God and in their own salvation, but if the many trips to the altar or to the riverbanks for baptism speak of anything, it is a complete lack of assuredness in this department. The God, small g God of the altar call, expects you to mind details. Pray right, walk right, talk right. He has said that he won't torment those who do everything right, but what if he changes his mind? He's the capricious sort. And this is true. And when we read Paul saying, Paul uses an interesting word there in Romans 8, for you did not get slavery spirit to fear again. That's an interesting word there in Romans 8, to fear again. Because the people Paul were talking to were idolaters, most recently idolaters. And it was a shock to them to hear of a God who was conciliated to them, who was satisfied, who looked upon them and smiled upon them in spite of their behavior. This was so anomalous, this was so strange, as well as being anomalous, that this is the exception to every God rule, the God we have. And even he, in order to show how great he was, in order for us to appreciate nearness to him, even he came across in the Hebrew scriptures as an angry God. He came across that way. On Mount Sinai, you had the thunder and lightning that scared the hell out of Samuel Clemens, i.e. Mark Twain. But that was necessary to do that, to realize how awesome he was. But what did God say about himself during those days? It was not in my heart. It wasn't my heart. Wasn't in my heart to see the blood of bulls and goats. Not at all. I want mercy, not sacrifice. And he wants fellowship, and he wants intimacy. He wants to be called daddy. But in order for us to enjoy that intimacy with him, we have to know how awesome he is, and how great he is, and how unapproachable he really is, apart from Christ. So what brings this calm? What brings this satisfaction? What brings this deity, capital D, who nothing can ruffle him? And as far as the Romans went, Paul is teaching the Romans the gospel that we're talking about today. And Paul says, God wants to calm you, not kill you. I did invent that phrase. That's pretty good too. This God wants to calm you, not kill you. Rule by fear. Rule by fear. This is the Christian God. I was tempted to tell my Omaha story. Well, I have an Omaha story. Yeah, it was in 1981, the last time I was in the, and this is related. I might tell this quick story and then read one more passage from this article and then pass it over to Tom. I had a girlfriend back in 1980. It's really my first serious girlfriend, but she was very difficult to please. And I was always walking on eggshells around her, always trying to do everything right because she was always this close to being in a bad mood, you know? And she always had a headache. She always had a headache. I carried aspirin with me everywhere. Do you need some aspirin? Do you need some aspirin? It wasn't very fun. So I'm getting ready to go on a transcontinental bicycle trip in May of 1980. And she said, let's go to the park. Let's climb a tree together the night before you leave. Okay, let's do that. I'm scared to death, just like these false gods. And I worship this girl, right? So we climb a tree and she proceeded to break up with me in that tree. Before I left. What? You know, when the bough breaks, the cradle will fall, I guess. So I was really depressed. I was leaving the next day with my friend to fly to Los Angeles, where I'd never been out west before. We put our two bicycles in the belly of the plane, flew to LAX June 6, 1980, took our bikes out, pedal bikes, mind you, with our packs, and we started pedaling across the city of Los Angeles on our way to Boston, Massachusetts. Well, my friend, after he went through the Mojave Desert, ended up quitting in Las Vegas, and I went the rest of the way by myself. Well, let me tell you what happened when I got to a little town called Fairview, Utah. I pulled my bike in this little grocery store, and I went in to get my usual, you know, Archway cookies and orange juice, you know, the lunch of champions. And there was this cute girl at the cash register. And so I struggled with, oh, I saw your bike out there. Wow, what are you? I'm bicycling across the United States, whatever. And her mom worked at the store too. So these two started talking to me and they were really friendly. And like I say, the girl was cute. And they said, oh, we'd love to have you at our house. Would you like to spend the night. I'm thinking, spend the night. But I was so dedicated to the trip, and I was looking at my average for the day, and I tried to average 80 miles a day. I've only gone 60 miles, and I said, I would like to, but I can't. I got to move on. I got to get to the next town. But I did take her, write her address and her name down. Her name was Sherry Harless. So I finished the trip by myself. I get to Boston, and I kept in touch. I wrote this girl. I said, I finished my trip, and then we exchanged telephone numbers, and we talked to each other on the phone. This is a girl I met randomly at a grocery store in Fairview, Utah. And I was still broke up. Oh, well, when I came home from the trip, I forgot to tell you this. Oh, I was a celebrity. My family got together, and my girlfriend that broke up with me in the tree, all of a sudden, she's wanting to get back with me. Because, you know, I'm a hero now. I finished this epic 3,364-mile bicycle trip. But she still had those headaches. She was still funny. She was still weird. She was still awkward. And I was still trying hard to please her like these false gods. So on one day, I phoned Sherry, this girl that I met, and I said, let's meet. Let's meet somewhere. Let's do something crazy. Let's just meet. And in my mind, I'm wanting to break away from this false god, from this scary girlfriend. And I'm thinking, this sounds crazy. I've never done anything like this. And I said, let's meet. And she goes, okay, where? She lives in Provo, Utah. I live in Canton, Ohio. So we looked at a map, and we just looked at some, what's the middle? So we picked Omaha, Nebraska. Omaha, Nebraska. Just randomly. Just, oh, that looks like about the middle. So one morning at 1 a.m., I got aboard a train, Amtrak train in Canton. She got aboard an Amtrak train in Salt Lake City, and we met at the train station in Omaha, Nebraska at 2 in the morning. And we couldn't get a room or anything like that, so we went to the airport, Epley Field. The last time I was at this airport, I landed there yesterday. I had memories from the last time I was there was 1981. And this crazy girl and I, we got a taxi cab, we went to Epley Field, the airport, and we found these wheelchairs, and we started pushing each other in these wheelchairs, just acting crazy, having fun. I never had so much fun in my life. This girl was so loose, I don't mean that in a bad way, loose, I said loose, no. She was so fun. She was so the opposite of my girlfriend in Ohio. And so we're just acting like kids in this airport, running around, just taking over the place. And then it was time to get a room, and she was savvy, much more savvy than I was. We got to a hotel, and I remember the clerk, she was standing behind me, and I'm just a kid. I'm very innocent. I'm a virgin. I have no, you know, I'm just a nice boy. I'm what am I, 19, 20 at this time? All right, so the clerk says, would you like one bed or two? I said one. I mean two. I said two. I was being the gentleman. So we get to the room. There's only one bed. I have a feeling she was standing behind me. When I said two, she's going. I just think that. But anyway, we had a wonderful time in Omaha for 2 days. We went to the Mutual of Omaha building. We ran up and down the steps like kids. And I realized then that there were other girls in the world that were fun, other girls in the world where you could be yourself, where you could relax, and we would write poetry together. I mean, in 2 days, we just had fun like kids. It wasn't a sex fest. It was a fun fest. I wasn't there for that. She wasn't there for that. But she did ask me, where did you tell your parents you went? Where did you tell them you went? I said, I told my parents I went to Omaha to meet some girl. She goes, you told your parents that? And they were fine with it? Yeah, my parents are cool. I said, what did you tell your parents? Well, I told him I was going to Provo to study. Oh, I said, oh, yeah, you're a Mormon. You're a Mormon. She goes, yeah. But then she says, I'm a bad Mormon. I said, that's the best kind. So my Canton girlfriend didn't last long when I realized there was another type of person out there where you can be free and you can be yourself and you can say anything, be anything.
At this point in the video in Omaha, ladies and gentlemen, the video glitched. I don't know what happened, and the audio, the microphone, the lapel microphone went, and so rest of the video is really poor. You can't hear the audio. So I'm just going to finish up this video doing what I did there, which was read the last part of my newsletter on No More Fear. So if you could just give me a couple more minutes, I want to close this loop and explain this to you. Mind you, I'm taking a verse from Romans chapter 8, verse 15 through 17. Let's take verse 15. For you did not get slavery's spirit to fear again, but you got the spirit of sonship in which we are crying, Abba, Father. I want to comment on this Abba before I close here. Abba is a nice little Aramaic word used by children of their gentle daddies. It's the equivalent of our papa or daddy. No false god would ever tolerate such a title. It would be way too familiar. It's not even a title, really. It's a term of endearment. The false gods refuse to fraternize with you. They want everybody quaking, crying, and jumping out the windows like the Cowardly Lion of Oz. This is how we know that ours is the true God, because he doesn't scare us. So when we cry, he wants us to cry out, Daddy. Now, on some days, this Abba thing, it's too intimate for me. I just can't work it up. It's not that I don't share intimacies with God, it's just that I can't always unburden myself of the hardness of life. I can easily call him God in these moments. That is, the moments when the hardness of life hits. But not so easily Papa. Even less so Daddy or Dad. I have to admit that when I hear someone call him Dad or Daddy in everyday discussion, it rubs me the wrong way. When I hear people using this term, to me, he's too almighty for this title in the midst of common discourse. I'm speaking now of my average day when I'm whistling along in an average state of mere unhappiness. I'm not saying I'm correct in this. I have my own brand of intimacy that has me venting everything to him, but again, as God. During those times, I refer to him as God because I feel his subjection. Because God means subjector. In fact, this is my favorite title for him. I don't really mind his subjection. It's better than anything the world offers. See, I can only call him Daddy when I am nearly completely broken. I have to get down there to do it. I'm glad it's there when I need it, but I can't do it when I'm in myself. Sorry. I pretty much got to be destroyed. I've been there to call out the Abba title. And I think there may be something to Paul saying in which we are crying, Abba, Father. See, I take this crying literally. I think that a person ought to be crying before they can properly exercise this endearment. Because in my opinion, it's too familiar for anything but tears. I may be wrong. I may be missing something here. But this is my instinct talking. Perhaps it's my personal preference. No one can even cry Abba, really, unless they have come up through the previous chapters of Romans. One has to have come up through the justification of chapters 3 and 4, and the conciliation, that is the peace of chapters 5 through 8, before one can call the Almighty God, even while one is broken in bed, Abba. This is why Paul waits until the end of chapter 8 to unveil it. So here are two more things that no false wannabe God ever dreamed of. Justification and conciliation. Those two things I just mentioned. Justification is God pronouncing you righteous in spite of what you do, because he sees you through Christ. That's a great thing. And conciliation is peace. Peace is what you feel after God has told you that you're righteous, that you're good, that you're cool, that you're great, that you're all right with him. What false god wants his devotees thinking of themselves as right and beyond sight of condemnation? No, they don't want that. That would be the consummation of the false god ego trip. And they're all on ego trips, especially the monster that I call the Christian God. The true God is different. He says, this is what he says. The true God says this: I'll make it so that my children can't sin their way out of my favor. They can't. No matter how hard they tried, they can't sin their way out of my favor. And then I'll make it so that they become my best friends, which is peace. This is justification. You can't sin your way out of God's favor. And peace, conciliation, based on the fact that you know that you can't sin your way out of God's favor. I'll make it so that they become my best friends. That's what the true God says. And only when we realize they were justified, that is declared to be righteous, and conciliated, that is that we have peace with God because he's at peace with us, only then can we take the chance, but it's not really a chance, of jumping into this God's lap, the true God, and rubbing cheeks with him. And only then can we cry out, Abba, Father.